From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Limbit Opic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, world, to Limbit Opic here on today's News Talk TNT, where we find the facts, we kill the spin, we express opinions, but tell it like it is about stories all around the world. And we dig deep. We have the time and the opportunity to really speak with our contributors and with yourselves as well. I'll come to that in a moment, without having to rush you. We can also have disagreements. Nobody gets cancelled here. And more than anything, all I ask you to do is generate your own points of view. I'll give you my opinions if I think they're useful, but it doesn't mean you have to embrace them. Big thank you to everyone who's on the tntradio.live chat at the moment. You've been very busy. My first guest today, Duncan White, who was talking about a seminal new premiere of a film in Leicester Square, didn't get the normal Leicester Square coverage, which is called Climate the Movie. Duncan was pointing out that there's absolutely no scientific justification for saying that human-generated carbon dioxide is wrecking the planet. And we were talking about the censorship, the fact that there's almost no coverage of it because it doesn't fit the zeitgeist. It doesn't go with the message that's meant to frighten you and make you buy ridiculously expensive energy and vote for politicians who are too ignorant to understand that human beings haven't got the capacity to drive climate in a measurable way. A few comments here before we go to our guest, who has some very interesting views about the penal system from an insider's perspective as well. We'll come to that in a moment. One of the most interesting recurring themes here is a general cynicism about American politics. Malibai says Biden's for the chop so they can bring in Big Mike. Craigifer says Big Mike doesn't want the job. I do think you're right if you mean Mike Pence, but I'm not sure who you do actually mean. Blodder says we spent 4 years denigrating the science of COVID, and now we want to get scientists to change people's minds on climate. It's a paradox. We need to weaponize these emotions, humanity-centered options, or we won't get anywhere. Well, that's an interesting point, actually. Science doesn't depend on emotion. It depends on fact, whereas non-scientific people and religions, or these cults, do tend to use emotional appeals. Maybe that's an easier thing for people to digest than having a look at hard facts. A few more here. Holly says, all rushing to a local vineyard to get their stupid cars charged. That's an interesting one. Very interesting. You'd have to read the whole thread to understand the details of that. But this whole idea about car charging. Oh, yes, of course. I know who Big Mike is. It's Michelle Obama. I'm trying to keep up. That's my producer telling me off. All right, Charlotte. I'm trying to keep up. I'm sorry. I'm doing a lot of work here. You try broadcasting on a Saturday morning. Thank you, Charlotte. Big Mike, Michelle, who could be a candidate. It could still be the candidate. If Joe Biden takes a tumble, of course. Holly says, I've just been out shouting at Tesla drivers, getting the blood pressure going. Holly, I don't let your blood pressure get too high. We don't want you to be doing that. We don't want you to be going crazy because we need your entertainment and your pathos and your sardonic criticism, sometimes of me, on the chat. Shout at the Tesla drivers. Take it out on them. Because they're rich enough. They've got a proper car as well, I'd say. One more before we're going to go to a quick poll before we go to my next guest. Holly says, they're going to destroy our worlds with their selfishness and stupidity. Sad, isn't it? And Sunday Girl says, I'll send it again. It was regarding how some presenters treat us like children. It's sad. Yes, well, I understand that. And we have to sow seeds, says Moulton. Lots of pushback there. If only you, dear viewers, were the Parliament of Britain, we'd be much better represented and we'd have much more sensible choices and we wouldn't be hobbling our economy with an insane drive to destroy our economy, including the destruction of our steel industry. We'll go to my next guest in a moment, but Siv, I believe, is on the line. Siv, good evening to you. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm here to drive you mad again. Just to come back to that comment there about, you know, TV presenters and all that treating you like children. I mean, that's the, I'm against a lot of that too. I mean, we get that here in Australia where, you know, it's a hot day and we're told that we need to hydrate ourselves. Well, you'd think living in a hot country, you'd know that you'd stay hydrated, stay cool, and avoid the sun. But we're told that as if we are the lowest common denominator, a bit like you guys, when you turn your radio or your TV on, you're told, now look, it's going to snow in the north, so make sure you've got your wellies on or something, or make sure you've got whatever it is, you know, make sure that you're away from the snow so you don't get frostbites. Oh, really? Like we didn't know that before? Seriously, you guys? You know? And that whole climate change stuff, I mean, hasn't that been changing for billions of years? And, you know, no matter what these people do, I don't think we'll make a difference. The only thing that will happen is that the rest of us will have to learn how to live in the caves like the cave people did. I've said this, and I think it's slowly starting to seep out, but I think, you know, we've got to be careful that they don't send us. I mean, I love my mod cons. I mean, apart from anything else, I like being able to switch my air conditioning on whenever I want. I love to be able to go and, you know, belch out the odd bit of fume when we get in our motor cars. I like all that stuff. I don't want to go back to the 1800s where I'm sitting in a cave scribbling down stuff, you know, just to get a message across. No thanks. That's not the life for me.
I think you make that point clearly, Siv. I have to tell you one other thing that really annoys me. When people say, oh, there's a climate crisis, there's going to be a 2-year drought, and then you, in the same state-sponsored TV station, right, yes, after their talk, there's talk of a 2-year drought, they go, oh, I'm really, it's really bad news, it's going to be raining all day again. I'm going, haven't you joined the dots, folks? We've got saturated ground in this country. No one's talking about that 2-year drought anymore in Britain, Siv,
no,
if you're going to go on a holiday, don't come to Britain for the weather, because it's raining. Go on, Siv.
No, and the other thing, too, before I let you go, the other thing they do as well is they conflate climate with weather. And I think we've got to separate the two, because I think climate is a very long-term thing and it's done over a long period of time, billions of years and so on. And the weather is, well, what we're getting today and tomorrow. And I hope, my friends of Britain, you're actually getting spring weather and it's not, you know, 5 degrees. Good to talk to you, Lambert.
We're getting warm rain instead of cold rain, Siv, if that's what you mean. Thanks very much indeed, Siv. Siv, always good value. From Australia, we are a truly global outlet, the first fully functioning online global media station, and hopefully the first fully functioning home of free speech as well. Today's news talk. Coming up in a moment, we'll be speaking to somebody who knows more than most about the workings, inner workings of our penal system. I want to test with her some of what seem to be the terrible contradictions in how we manage crime and punishment. Don't know where that's going to go, but I know it'll be fascinating. That's going to be with Vanessa Frake-Harris, who's got decades of experience of that penal system. All of that with me, Lambert Topic, here on TNT.
Giving you what you want.
I want the fact.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Got it right the first time.
You did.
Welcome to the show, Vanessa Frake-Harris, and thank you very much for joining us here on today's News Talk. I realise I made one slight mistake. I keep saying you've got internal experience of the workings of the penal system. It makes it sound like you were a prisoner. That's not correct, though, is it? Tell us about what experience you have of the prison system. Let's get this right so that you don't have to think.
Well, I worked for just under 30 years in the prison system, both as an officer and as a governor, Wormwood Scrubs in West London. But you could say that is more than the average life sentence. So I know one or two things about prisons.
And what I'm hoping to talk about with you in the second and third parts of the programme, so after we've had a more general discussion, is the effectiveness of the British penal system from your honest perspective, and I'll put my cards on the table. I've got to believe there's a better way of doing it. And then also, a couple of years ago, you got into an interesting controversy about whether we should be allowed to shout at prisoners or not. And we'll go into that as well, perhaps, because I watched that with interest and did feel that there was a certain amount of lack of understanding by some of the interviewers who were taking on your point of view. But let's start with the big picture here. When you worked in the prison system, what was your overarching view of the effectiveness of how Britain deals with the tens of thousands, close to 100,000 people that we have behind bars?
When I first joined the prison system, I joined in 1986, so things were much different then. There was much more discipline. There was a sense of, you know, you could make a difference as a member of staff. And then over the years, I've kind of watched the prison system in this country be eroded away, you know, lack of funding, lack of investment, lack of interest in our justice system overall. Nowadays, having been away from the justice system for about 5 or 6 years now, I look on it, back on it with fondness, but I worry for those staff and those prisoners that are encapsulated in the jails these days. I think that there is a significant lack of understanding of what prison is about. You know, it's not, yes, it's about punishment. Yes, it's about protecting the public. Yes, it's about retribution, but it's also about addressing offending behaviours and reducing that reoffending. And I think, you know, as a country who lock up the most prisoners in Western Europe and who has the worst reoffending rates in Western Europe, we have some serious issues in this country. You know, we're at the point now where our prisons are overcrowded. You know, that's down to different factors like an increase of sentencing by MPs who don't think of the knock-on effect of that. That's down to more police officers, so there's more criminals caught. And of course, last year we had the barrister strike for just under 6 months, and that caused a backlog of criminal cases coming through, which is only just starting to be addressed now. So, you know, every political party wants to be the party of law and order. Every political party wants to lock prisoners up to appease the public because they're vote winners. But what is not a vote winner is to stand up and say, well, let's invest in reducing reoffending in this country. And unfortunately, that's where we are.
When I was a member of parliament, which I did for 13 years, I didn't feel that my fellow parliamentarians particularly regarded making sentences stiffer as an element of rehabilitation. I felt what they were doing was trying to look tough, to say, if you misbehave in my country, if I'm in charge, then you will suffer the full force of detention and that'll make you sorry. I didn't hear people saying, let's work on the underlying causes of crime. For example, the increasing differentiation in relative wealth between the richest and the poorest. And it was simply an attempt to think that if you hit somebody hard enough, they'll stop offending.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we all know that that doesn't work. You know, you've got to invest in people. You know, most, probably 60% of prisoners who come into jails can't read or write. You know, many of them are addicted to drugs, addicted to alcohol, are homeless. These are all things that you've got to address. You know, it's no good just locking them up, throwing away the key for 6 months and then sending them out and into society and expecting them to not reoffend. You know, it just doesn't work. And until we get our heads around that as a society, I think we're going to be in this, you know, well, let's just keep locking them up. I think the prediction, it's about 85,000 we're locking up today. And I think the prediction in the next couple of years is over 106,000. You know, that is quite a lot of prisoners to cope with, and to think that every single prisoner place, adults, male adults, costs around £50,000 per prisoner place per year. So, you know, that's yours and mine tax money, if we don't mind, you know.
We'll go to break in a couple of minutes, and I want to get into more detail about specifics like whether we should be locking people up for drugs policy and whether you can get a cure for addiction in prison and so on. But just for now, some people say that we've got the whole thing wrong, that the prison service should be self-funding, that the prisoners, like they do, I think, in Mongolia, the prisoners should be made to work for their food. And if they don't make enough money like an independent business cost center, then they starve. What would you say to that?
My answer to that would be, look, we are a civilized society. You know, there are very vulnerable people in prison. There are people with mental health issues that shouldn't be there. We have an awful lot of foreign national prisoners that shouldn't be there. I think, you know, going back to that sort of, you know, water and damp running down the walls, that is, it's all about how you treat people. If you treat people poorly, when you send them out, they are going to act poorly. If you treat them with humanity and decency and work with them, you are going to bring them on side. And that's just what I've always done in, you know, 30 odd years. And that's what I've seen the most results with. Treating people badly, you know, locking them in a cell, throwing away the key and leaving them there for 6 months, 12 months. And then at some stage, you've got to let them out and let them out onto society. And, you know, that just breeds anger, breeds contempt, breeds resentment. And, you know, that whole sort of bubble is just going to be pushed onto society and they're going to reoffend. And that's just not the way to go.
Okay, let's go into the details a little bit more, and I'll read some of the comments and calls coming in on this subject as well. And I want to start exploring some policy areas where I'll express my opinion too, particularly on drugs policy. You're listening to the Len Bitopic Show here on Today's News Talk TNT. See you in a minute.
TNT's James Freeman.
Now that I'm sitting on the other side of the fence, I see the budget in a very different light. I find the discussions and leaks in the press in the weeks running up to the budget totally patronising. You know, will he, won't he give us some tax cuts? When the reality is that nothing in the budget will make any material difference to anyone, pretty much. That's usually the story. It is a game of musical chairs where the government giveth with one hand and taketh with the other. And we're all reminded about how little money that we've got left in our pockets.
James Freeman on Today's News Talk, TNT.
Sometimes a car comes along that changes everything, with innovations never thought possible and features that make you wonder, how did people survive without this? This is that time, and this is that car. This is the world's first DWB. Equipped with transparent doors to eliminate reasonable suspicion, whatever that means. A 10-2 steering wheel that keeps hands visible at all times. We remove the glove box so there's no confusion about what the driver is reaching for. With a touch of a button, the ultrasonic biometric scanner displays the license and registration of the driver to ensure contactless exchange of information. With no trunk, nothing can be concealed, so therefore, there is nothing to search and seize. To ensure you will never be mistaken for breaking the speed limit, we've installed limited edition airless tires. And we removed the engine because, honestly, why risk it? DWB, the first vehicle of its kind, where the safety feature is the car itself.
I have a feeling these are the suspects in question. The two occupants look like the people involved in the armed robbery. I'm approaching the vehicle. Request backup. The driver matches the description because of a wide-set nose.
You are about to hear
Today's News Talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Today's News Talk TNT with me, Len Bitopic, as we dig deep into the subjects of the day and potential contradictions in how we run our society. Still with me, we've got Vanessa Drake Harris, who knows a great deal from her 30 years of experience of the British penal system. A few comments first before I go back to Vanessa. I often end up creating these temporary government plans. If I ruled the world, who would be in charge as well? Amali Bites volunteers to run the military, says that's one post sorted, adds that Mali Bites' first mission would be to round up all the members of parliament, give them a parachute and drop them off over Ukraine on the front line. I suspect that would probably substantially change British foreign policy if you did that. But of course, since it would be our government anyway, we wouldn't be at war in the first place. But there we go. Mogden responding to whether you really have to tell people to wear wellies when it's raining. That was Siv's point. He called in from Australia. Mogden says, judging by the amount of adults I see waiting for the green man at the Pelican Crossing on a clear road, they do need to be told to drink in hot weather. Fair point, Mogden. Now, I don't let my child cross usually if there's no green man, but that's because I just want my child to understand that the default position is to go with a green man. But really, if there's nothing coming, once you understand that, then you can be a bit more flexible. But I do think that we follow instructions, sometimes crazily dumb instructions, like spend three times more on your energy because there's a climate crisis, which is one of the dumbest things that we're told. You know my views on that, and we'll come back to that again tomorrow. Mogden says about the surveillance society, a shop assistant in a shop yesterday was wearing a police type body cam. What's going on in that shop? Where does that end? Why do we all wear body cams in that case? Some comments about hate, not hope, and maybe you'll get 2 years for stickering if you advertise Climate the Movie. Yes, that's one of the concerns. Maybe in Canada, you'd be locked away in house arrest for daring to suggest there isn't a climate emergency. Let's remember, of course, that Canada has been allowing one major power station in the UK to knock down their historic ancient woodland and stick it in a power station in the north of England, thousands of kilometres from that historic woodland, in order to give us green energy. It's absolutely perverse. Let's leave that for now. Let's get back to the subject in hand. And we were talking about prison and the system. Red says, totalitarian UK, no dissent or even discussion of the authorised narrative is tolerated. And a few more comments about, really, well, the authoritarian state. Vanessa, in an authoritarian state, you're much more likely to get locked up for crimes perhaps that you didn't commit. In terms of the big picture, before you go into the details, you're free now to say this. How do you feel about the permissiveness or authoritarianism of our society as a whole? Are we misusing the penal system to try and shut down dissent?
Oh gosh, that's a one for a Saturday morning, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know if we are. I mean, it's very difficult. You know, we're very clear in this country that we're a democratic country and that we can, you know, we have the right to protest. We have the right to say pretty much what we like. But that's only to a point, isn't it? You know, prisons, when we had the 2010 riots in London, you know, our Wormwood Scrubs was full of prisoners coming in on a daily basis that were arrested for one thing and another to do with the riots and that. And I think sometimes, you know, it was easier to arrest them, throw them in the back of a police wagon and bring them straight into Wormwood Scrubs and charge them with a fray, rather than, you know, maybe giving them a caution or whatever. But I think, I don't think we use it so much in an authoritarian way. I think we still look at as a punishment and a means to an end. So we think about punishment, we think about retribution, but I don't think we think about reoffending or offending. And I think that is the issue. We'd much rather, you know, lock somebody away for 6 months for shoplifting from the local supermarket to feed a drug habit or because they're hungry or whatever, then think about the ramifications of jailing that person for 6 months. So, you know, out of 6 months, they'll do three. Out of that 3 months, you know, they've probably lost their job if they had one. They might have lost their flat if they've had one. They could have lost their relationship. And we're sending them out after 3 months with real criminals, learning how to do it properly. And I think that we don't use community sentences like we should. I think we would be far better off, you know, making that person do something useful in the community that he's offended or she has offended against. And I think that, you know, that people say, oh, you know, they're going to do away with under 12-month sentences. But in actual fact, under 12-month sentences are no use nor ornament to anybody. You can do very little work with somebody who's got a 12-month sentence when, actual fact, they'll only do 6 months. It's very difficult to work with somebody as you know, not just prison officers, but, you know, education staff, psychologists, psychiatrists, probation, any of those sort of multidisciplinary facets of the prison service.
I had one reason I wanted to speak with you today is because the government is talking about creating a whole new level of crime now, about extremism. And the inference is that there could be some sort of sentencing there. I take that seriously because Julian Assange has been now behind bars for no perceived crime that he's been found guilty of for like a decade, basically. One way or another, he's been incarcerated. So I take this very seriously. And I grew up in Northern Ireland where you had internment, which meant that you could be detained without trial indefinitely. So we do this sort of stuff. The question, therefore, I have to ask you is, when you see the government threatening to essentially shut down debate by making extremism, whatever that means, illegal, how does that make you feel, given that the prison system, the detention system, as witnessed by the Assange case, could be used as a tool for what some people say, political control?
Well, that is the worry, isn't it? Because it can be, you know. I was I worked with quite a few alleged IRA people in the early 80s who were literally just taken off the street and put inside and kept there for their views. And you know, it's very difficult to, because all that does is make people very bitter. So you're sending somebody out eventually who has been locked up, taken away from their family, their life, their, you know, their freedom. You know, you're letting them out a very bitter and angry person. And that is the worry of that. With extremism, well, it's very difficult at the moment. You know, we initially, as a society, we think of extremism, we think of Muslim extremists, because that is usually at the forefront. But there are many different kinds of extremists. There's right-wing extremists, there's the animal liberation extremists, you know. So it's not just one religion either. You know, Christians can be extremists. So I think that the government has tried, specifically since the Palestinian marches since October the 7th or 8th, to crack down on this whole sort of issue. And I think, I'm not sure that going down this road, we know what extremist is. We don't need to be told it's now something different as a society. You know, like, you know, don't wear your, or put your wellies on in the rain. You know, I don't believe anybody in this country doesn't know what extremist views are, whichever views they are, and on whatever side they are. So, yeah, I could see that it could be a tool.
Yeah, my work, I worked as Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland for a whole decade, and I met many of the people who had been put behind bars for their political views. I found them some of the most deep thinkers, because their whole lives had been changed, altered, prevented to some extent, but through incarceration, on the basis of their genuinely held ideological beliefs. Doesn't matter whether you agreed with the IRA or indeed the UDA, they were put into prisons with other people with the same views. And they sat there for years, and some of them paid the price for it with their lives by going on hunger strike. I've never believed that incarcerating someone for their sincerely held views makes an iota of difference. It makes them into martyrs. And I'm guessing from your inference that you don't think that detention is going to alter somebody's fundamental beliefs, whether it's about racism, Islamism, the British state, or anything else.
No, I don't think it does. I think if anything, it hardens their resolve to their belief. You know, if somebody took me away from my family, my home, my life, stuck me in a prison because of what I believed, I'd make damn sure that I'd believe it even more. You know, I wouldn't be changing just so that, you know, I could be accepted in society. I don't see that is the route down to go. You know, the prison service has tried to do a lot of work with extremists of all types. You know, we've had various courses and groups, but at the end of the day, you know, we all know that those people went out with the same views that they had in. You know, you can say, oh yeah, I believe that, yes, I've changed my view, but actually, have they really? How can you prove that?
So then let's look at some case studies. I have to put on record, when I was a member of parliament, I advocated for the legalization and regulation of all drugs. And I have a very simple reason for that. I don't think you stop someone being an addict by making them into a criminal. And to me, the big crime when it comes to drugs is creating a massive multi-billion pound after sales sector where entrepreneurial individuals can make tax-free fortune, tax-free by definition, really, by getting people addicted and then serving that addiction. But instead, what we do is we put drugs users behind bars. Where do you stand on this?
Well, you know, I think I have seen the effects of drugs, all drugs, whether that be from spice, heroin, cocaine, meths, cannabis, you know, and, you know, some of the effects on people and on their families are quite disturbing, really. Personally, I don't agree with drugs. I don't agree with the people who push drugs on kids, use kids to push drugs around. Would that actually stop if it was legalized? Would they suddenly pay taxes on their little cash transactions? I'm not sure. And I do think that we need to do more in this country about addressing people's drug habits. Mm. You know, when I first joined the prison service, we used to make prisoners go cold turkey. There was no methadone dosages given out. They were literally locked in a cell and made to go cold turkey. And, you know, the nurses used to tell them, well, you can't die from not taking drugs. I mean, you could die from not taking alcohol, or you can absolutely self-harm and everything, but actually stopping taking drugs. They used to tell the prisoners, but thankfully we've moved on, and now there's a methadone maintenance scheme. And I think, you know, our outreach and inreach mental health policies have much, much more improved, thankfully. I know, you know, I've been to Amsterdam. I've seen, you know, every street corner you go on, you know, it smells of cannabis everywhere. And that may be for some people, and I don't condone it, and I don't particularly want it in my vicinity, but I understand that there are, I don't want to say that there are sort of, there are advantages to making drugs legal, because I'm not sure that when you've got such an industry where it is, you know, I mean, some of the seizures that they've made, you know, coming over into this country, have been millions and millions of pounds worth of heroin and cocaine, et cetera, et cetera. Will that actually, you know, suddenly stop? I don't believe that it would.
That's interesting.
I think for me, it's the people who are addicted to drugs that I'm most concerned with. The dealers and, you know, the big drug barons, I couldn't care less whether they're locked up for 12, 15 years. Personally,
well, my rule would be, we can't go further into it, because I did study this quite a lot when I was a member of parliament, actually, because I dealt with quite a lot of drug addicts when I was in my constituency, and it was a rural area. I wouldn't have expected it to be as prevalent as it was. My view is that if you legalize and regulate the supply, then the bottom drops out of the dealership anyway, because you just go and get your cheap, reliable supply from the state and you pay something for it, but at least it's under control. In Britain, actually, until around 1973, in the Misuse of Drugs Act, there were only a couple of thousand registered heroin addicts, and the number was going down, and the population of those addicts was getting older. And then we made it illegal, and suddenly there was an after sales motive to deal with it. But we're not going to get further on that one now. I don't want to spend the whole time on that. How about this then? somebody, one of the offenders who came to see me and was in trouble again, he said to me, he volunteered to me, he said, the reason I'm a criminal now is because once I had a criminal record, I couldn't get work. And I thought, well, what's the hell's the point of trying now? I'll just go back to criminality because the state's going to throw me out anyway. No one's going to employ me. What do you make of that?
Yeah,
that sounds to be fairly compelling, you know, rationale.
I mean, it is difficult. I don't lie. I mean, with when you work with offenders and as they come towards their sentence, your goal is to send them out of jail with somewhere to live, a job to work, and the right support that will support them ongoing in their freedom. But it is difficult. I mean, there are some fabulous companies like Timpson's who always employ convicted prisoners who have been released. There are many companies that come into jails and work with prisoners with a view to getting them out. It is difficult, though. You know, if you're a small employer and you have two people come for a job and one has a criminal record and one doesn't, which one are you going to go for? Mm-hmm. You know, it may be that you take a chance on that person. It may be that you just think, no, that risk is too great. And that's what it's about, is are you willing to accept the risk of taking somebody who's been convicted of a crime? You know, I think it all depends also on what the crime is. You know, if it's theft from your last previous employment, well, then obviously you're not going to be very, very, very enthusiastic about employing them again. And I think it is difficult, but that is where the investment in our prison system needs to happen, with offending behavior programs, investing in companies to come in to take prisoners upon release, to give them work. That's where it needs to happen, not you know, sitting back and just expecting people to walk out the gate and, you know, join and become a useful member of society. You know, these people need help and support, and that's what we should be focusing on as a society.
I've got something. I get all these different inputs while we're on air, and this one's really got people going. I'll read things from the TNT Radio.live chat just after the break, but something that's come in to me as a direct message. She says, I know somebody who's killed hundreds of thousands of people, but instead of going to prison, he got employed as a peace envoy in the Middle East. I wonder who she means. Just stay with
so
us.
So do I.
I think we all know who she means. Stay with us. We're talking about perhaps the contradictions between the super rich former politicians and those people who end up in our penal system here on today's News Talk TNT. I'm Len Bitopic. I'll see you in a minute.
From weather and traffic reports
to news of political developments,
we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
Too many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked in the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre, surtout que je ne m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with a free press. Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
The Kids Cancer Project funds vital research into childhood cancers. And you fund the Kids Cancer Project. Funding research means giving children back their lives. And who knows what kids with cancer could grow up to do? The Kids Cancer Project. Survival starts with science. Donate now.
The Kids Cancer Project.
This is the Limbit Opic Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining me, Limbit Opic, here on today's News Talk, TNT, as we have live, unedited, honest debate about issues affecting the world. And we're talking about the penal system, and it might be various contradictions, partly kicked up by the fact that the government in Britain wants to go hard on extremism, which could bang up even more people into our prisons. I'm with Vanessa Frey-Karras, who MBE, I should say, who has 30 years of professional experience working in the prison system. One thing we seem to agree on is that you don't change an ideology by banging somebody up behind bars. Different views potentially on what we do about drugs. I do feel on the basis of data, I suppose, that we shouldn't we should do something else. We should legalize drugs and put dealers in prison. But there's a difference of view. We haven't got time to go further in that one. I'm definitely going to come back to that subject in the future, though. And we're also talking about how we could make things better. A few comments before I go back to Vanessa. Mazzy says, Catch-22 system, Lembit. Absolutely. If you haven't read Catch-22, definitely do. Joseph Heller's greatest book. I'll make a confession about that in a minute. Holly says, quite right, Lembit. It turns a first-time offender into a lifelong criminal to be put away. That is my concern. Mogden says, sounds the same as Big Pharma then, Lembit. A couple more. Red says, can anything be banned that is naturally here anyway, such as cannabis? That's a good point. Red suggests it's ridiculous. I personally think that cannabis has probably done less harm to the world than alcohol. But I haven't got the actual data to back that up. It's certainly a debate that we should have. That's the point. I want to have a debate about it. I want to get this right, because what I said is an opinion, because it's so hard to get data about the relative effect of these drugs. A few more. So many comments here. Holly says, it's probably easier to get drugs inside a prison than a good bowl of broccoli. Then another one is... what about the people, this is Holly again, what about all the people addicted to mind-altering antidepressants in the UK? Millions of them. Who's the drug-pushing criminal there? Just two more. Red asks, can we still have alcohol and tobacco? Is that okay? Good point. They could be Class A drugs in a different world if they were invented now. Madrid says, the CIA are the biggest drug barons, helped by the UN. It is interesting that after our invasion of Afghanistan, Afghanistan increased its heroin production, or the production of the raw materials for heroin. Two questions for you, Vanessa Frey-Karras. Is it easier to get drugs or a bowl of broccoli in prison?
I've never seen a bowl of broccoli come into jail. I have seen many drugs, though. So what does that tell you?
Holly could be right. Holly could be pushing broccoli. She could end up pushing broccoli into our prisons.
Yeah, absolutely. Mind you, it'd probably be boiled to within an inch of its life if it was in prison.
No, there you are. I've met broccoli, Holly. I reckon she lives on the farm. She knows what to do with broccoli. I had the best broccoli I've had for years yesterday. Total coincidence, Holly. It wasn't Holly's, by the way. And just a confession about Joseph Heller, not related to what we're discussing. I was once invited to meet Joseph Heller. I think Catch-22 would be one of the books I would take on a desert island if I could and if I was stranded. And I didn't meet Joseph Heller that evening because I forgot. I gave a friend of mine a lift on my motorbike. That's why I forgot. I didn't meet Joseph Heller, and he's dead now. That was a criminal omission on my part. Let's return to what we were discussing, though. There's a debate to be had about where we stand on drugs, and I'm not going to go into the data now, but I note to self, I'll definitely have that extensive debate one day, perhaps even make a theme of it on one of my Saturday or Sunday shows. But looking at the penal system as it is, If you were the Home Secretary, if you were in charge for 5 years, you've got 5 years to fix things, what would you change, Vanessa?
I'd have a, if funds were unlimited, which I hope they would be, I'd have a complete overhaul, a multi-task force of overhauling the whole of the justice system, from the amount of time people spend on remand, to the courts, to the judges, to the prisons, to the fact that many of our prisons are 200 plus years old. They are many unfit for purpose, rat infested. They don't cope with modern technology very well. So, you know, somebody said about getting drugs into prison. Well, you know, when you've got an old Victorian prison that's bang smack in the middle of, you know, London or Liverpool or Manchester, wherever, it's very easy access for people to throw drugs over walls, to throw them over in dead pigeons, you know. Yeah, it is. It is. I wouldn't say it's easy to get drugs into prison, but prisoners and people outside pushing drugs into prison are very clever in their methods. And, you know, I think I'd also invest in staffing and better training for staff, better corruption training, better security training. You know, most of the people who are recruited now are recruited online. There's no face-to-face interviews, which I think tells a lot about somebody when you're face-to-face with them rather than online. And I think that I think we need to look at our prison sentencing and see what actually fits the crime, because I don't think that it does. You know, you've got people who can stab somebody who get, you know, a suspended sentence. You've got somebody who gets done for shoplifting who gets 6 months in jail. You know, it's and also, you know, I think judges are quite out of touch with you and me, that, you know, Joe Public. And I think that quite often they don't recognise the impact that their sentencing on prisoner A has on the family, the victims, and I think that that's something that needs to be looked at. But for me personally, I think we need to take the politics out of our prison system, because it's not a vote winner to stand up and say, you know, we're going to invest in our prisons, we're going to invest in offending behaviours. It's a vote winner to stand up and say, you know, we're going to lock all these people up and increase these sentences and be the party of law and order.
When I was Member of Parliament, I started going and having some involvement with the Shrewsbury, Her Majesty's Prison in Shrewsbury, which was very near by my constituency. Had I been re-elected, we were planning a rehabilitation programme where the canal, which had long ago been made derelict from one place to another, about 10 maybe miles of it, was going to be a focus of voluntary contribution by prisoners who are clearly stir crazy. When I went in there, they weren't particularly stupid people. Some of them clearly had mental health issues, but others were fairly accepting of the fact that they were doing time because they'd done something wrong. They gambled badly, if you like. And that just didn't happen because I lost my seat. But it did seem to me there's a willingness by people who probably weren't just play acting for me to say, well, actually, I'd quite like to have skills because I would like to break out of this. Just a few points here. There's a whole big debate about broccoli, but I'm not going to go into that now. You also remind me of a song by a fictional character called John Shuttleworth, played by the comedian Graham Fellows, and it goes, "You're like Manchester, you've got strange ways." But I don't remember the rest of the song. When you're talking about the crime, the punishment fitting the crime, I've always been worried about that. And it seemed to me that the actual punishment fitted the amount you were willing or able to afford to pay for your defense, so that a very wealthy person could get off, perhaps on a technicality, while somebody with very little money and potential drug addiction would just have to take what's coming to them.
Yeah, I think, you know, we spend an awful lot of money on legal aid in this country. And, you know, I think some solicitors are more inclined to take on difficult cases than others. I think, you know, some just go about it as and when. And I think, I'm not saying, you know, it should fit the crime, as in, you know, if you steal an apple, you get your hand lopped off. But I do think that there needs to be more understanding of how sentences are given out. You know, there was a judge a couple of weeks ago who gave a woman who'd stabbed her ex-boyfriend twice, but because she was 7 weeks pregnant with another man, he gave her a suspended sentence because he didn't think that the prison system could cope with a pregnant woman. Well, the prison service are brilliant coping with pregnant women. You know, they ensure that every single baby that's born is not born in prison, so it doesn't have the prison address on its birth certificate. You know, there's 24-hour nursing cover, there's midwives, there's pre-birth classes, etc., etc. So that, you know, so I never understood why he made, you know, something like that an issue, and I don't understand how somebody could stab somebody and get I think she was got a suspended sentence for a couple of months. You know, that just doesn't make sense to me. And I think, you know, the victim and also, you know, his family didn't understand it either. And I think that that's something that we need to remember, that for every prisoner there is a victim.
I want to finish where we started. I recognize we left quite a lot of loose ends in the discussion, but you made me realize there's quite a lot for us here at Today's News Talk to tackle, things that you don't hear on the state-sponsored media because they don't want to upset their paymasters. Things such as, what is the right drugs policy for countries? What is the right policy when it comes to rehabilitation? And how much should we be spending in stopping that reoffending? To what extent are we in a dangerous pre-crime minority report situation? But what I want to finish is where we started and what prompted us to ask you to be here in the first place. This question of extremism. I'm worried that we're heading towards a place where, whatever the intentions of the law, the state of any colour, Labour, Conservative, anybody else, could actually lock up enemies of the state and use the prison system to silence opposition. My personal opinion is that's what's happened to Julian Assange. In your experience, number one, did you ever see someone who you thought was locked up for ideological reasons who shouldn't be there? You implied that you'd met people from the terrorists, the paramilitaries. Yeah. The second thing is, what's your prognosis for the immediate future?
Well, I think, the immediate future, I think the world's gone mad. I think it's absolutely lost the plot and lost its direction, both in this country and abroad. And I think it's a worrying time. You know, I have a 21-year-old daughter and I worry about her every day. I think with, you know, the prison service being used to lock people up who disagree with the state, I've seen it, you know, that whether that be extremist in one form or another, and it is worrying, and there's very little that you can do working in a prison to work with somebody who's been taken away from life and thrown in prison for what they believe in. You know, we're supposedly a democratic society that has free speech, but I feel sometimes that free speech is being eroded day by day. And I think that all of us should be worried about that. But, you know, working in the prison system, we can't dictate who comes into the jail. We just have to look after them to the best of our ability and try and work with them. And that's what I tried to do. And I know that there's many thousands of prison staff who do that on a daily basis, sometimes under very difficult circumstances.
Vanessa, fascinating to speak with you. I think we've only just touched the surface. You will come back in the future, maybe to have a deeper debate about drugs policy, which clearly you do have views on. Would that be okay?
Yeah, I'd love to, Lembit.
really fascinating. Thank you so much for taking of your time today on a Saturday morning here in the UK. I'll let you go now. That's Vanessa Frake-Harris with some really interesting circumspect points of view about the prison system. Let me know what you think too. I will get deeper into the drugs debate because I think that's a really interesting one. Also, do you think that there is a risk with the way that the state is altering the law means they could just bang up opposition, that Julian Assange won't be an exception? He'll just be a warning to others. Coming up next, somebody who will never be locked up for being shy, a man who wakes up angry in the morning and expresses it with a delightful artistic eloquence. Paul McGowan will be joining us from the west of England afterwards to give us his take on what's been a rather unusual week. And I just want to finish on this before we go to the break. Seb says broccoli is the only vegetable known to man which can go from hot to cold between the plate and the mouth. I've noticed that too. Thanks very much indeed to my guest. I'll be back in a few minutes to talk with Paul McGowan. I'm Len Bitopic. This is The Len Bitopic Show. You're watching TNT. See you in a moment.